a lawsuit over Indiana's eviction moratorium. The IHSAA will go forward with fall sports, plus former Governor Joe Kernan's legacy and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending July 31st, 2020.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, Hoosier renters and homeowners will be shielded from evictions and foreclosures for another couple of weeks, even as Governor Eric Holcomb faces a lawsuit over that moratorium. Governor Holcomb announced he's extending his eviction foreclosure moratorium through August 14th. He emphasizes, though, that those who have struggled with payments need to work with their landlords and mortgage holders.
We do want to make sure, however, in the next couple weeks here, that folks are making payment plans.
A group of landlords recently sued Holcomb in federal court, alleging the moratorium violates their constitutional rights. The governor says the lawsuit won't affect his decision-making.
We'll follow up on our own convictions. I won't live under the threat of a lawsuit. We feel very comfortable about where we are right now and where we can go under the law.
Indiana's rental assistance program opened in July and already received more than 20,000 applications, more than the state anticipated it could serve. Holcomb says the state will find resources for its rental assistance program if the initial funding is exhausted. How much longer can and perhaps should Holcomb go forward with an eviction moratorium? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Joey Fox, Lindsay Erdody, reporter for the Indianapolis Business Journal, and Nikki Kelly, State House reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Ann Delaney, if you were the governor, how much would this lawsuit worry you?
Not at all. And if I were the governor, I wouldn't be extending it 2 weeks. I mean, what does that do for people? The middle of the month? I mean, we have upwards of 300,000 Hoosiers filing for unemployment compensation, and we will have a homeless population that won't be contained if this isn't extended. And it should be extended until the COVID scare is over, and that may be the end of the year. And if he had any leadership ability, that's what the governor would do, not in two-week increments so that everybody is uncertain what happens.
Do you think extending the eviction moratorium till perhaps the end of the year is realistic?
Well, we don't know yet. I mean, the governor has said from the beginning we're going to let the data drive this, not dates. I was under the understanding that this was going through August 24th. I think the governor is taking this as we go. There's a lot of people involved. There's a lot of money involved that's going out. I think the governor's following the data, and I think that is leadership ability, Ann.
No, it's not. He's following what Trump says to do.
I don't think that's...
Oh, I do.
I'm not sure that's always true, because he's been doing a lot of things that Donald Trump hasn't been a fan of so far.
Well, what about schools?
I don't think a lot of schools. He's letting the schools decide.
Oh, yeah, that's leadership, right. Uh-huh.
Lindsay, the lawsuit came from small landlords who don't own thousands of properties across Indiana. Do you think that, and they propose perhaps a moratorium that isn't for everyone, but only those who can, for instance, prove a loss during the COVID-19 pandemic. Do you think we'll see a sort of revised moratorium in the future to keep those smaller landlords in mind?
It's possible. It'll be interesting to see what happens. I don't think it's realistic to continuing to extend it over and over and over and over again. I mean, at some point, it's going to come to an end, whether that's the end of the year, whether that's in 2 months, we don't know. And I think there's going to have to be something kind of in the middle to figure out how do you not have a bunch of evictions when it does come to an end. And I've talked to housing advocates about this, too, and I'm not sure anyone has figured out the exact right solution for that yet.
Because the state's rental assistance program, which is independent of Marion County's rental assistance program, which is important to note, but neither of those are going to provide all of the money that these folks need, right?
No. I mean, at some point, the rubber's going to hit the road. I do think there's probably a middle ground out there to where the tenants have to prove a loss in revenue. I don't think that's out of the, you know, out of the question to ask to happen.
I think you had to, if I remember correctly, you had to prove that for the rental assistance
program. Right,
but
you, but not for the moratorium itself.
Right, so right, right.
There are landlords out there who need that money to pay the mortgage. And so in the end, we could just end up with a bunch of foreclosed properties, and that doesn't help anyone either.
But at least you won't have people living on the street under those circumstances, even with the foreclosed property. Somebody, whoever holds the note, will take the building over. They won't necessarily evict all the people living there.
I mean, that's a big if.
Well, it's a big if.
I mean, it's not in their interest to have it empty either.
I will say, too, which is important to note, if you're a landlord who agreed to participate in that rental assistance program, you had to agree that you couldn't evict the person for the length of the time mm-hmm. that you're going to get money from the program, and assuming that the person is, you know, you've worked out a sort of payment plan of some sort. Well, the Indiana High School Athletic Association announced this week that fall sports will go on as planned.
The IHSAA says girls' golf practices can begin as soon as today, Friday the 31st, while other sports can begin practicing Monday, August 3rd. Actual games and contests can begin for girls' golf on the 3rd and all other sports on August 15th. The organization didn't outline any further cancellations or adjustments, but many decisions about school in general, including high school sports, will be driven by local school leaders and health departments.
Joey Fox, we might talk about this later in the show. We're seeing a lot of schools who aren't reopening to in-person classes now as those dominoes continue to fall. Do you feel like it's safe then to go forward with all fall sports?
Well, I think the IHSAA, right, as kind of the governing body for this, is setting up the ability for schools to participate in fall sports. I don't get the sense from what I read that they're forcing everybody to go and, sure, you know, get on the football field. I think that schools are going to have to make that decision using guidance from the State Department of Health, the CDC, et cetera, using public health authorities to make decisions for how best to do this. And can you change the way you practice? Can you change the way you play? All of that to ensure that kids have a safe way to participate. But sports are important for life for a lot of these kids, and it is important that we try to find a way to get these kids as close to back to normal as we can.
It seems to me that to what Joey just said, is IHSAA here really doing exactly what he said? It's, we're not going to stop you from doing anything, but you have to make the decision as to whether or not you can proceed.
It's the same lack of leadership on the governor's part, okay? We ought to have guidelines for this. It's great to say, do it if safe. Well, the Marlins tried that, and now they have 17 of their players that are infected. And they've got all the resources in the world to make sure that safety is there. I'm not sure all the high schools involved in this have those same resources. And I don't think it's as important. I like sports. I like high school sports. I like college sports. But it isn't as important as A, the education, and B, keeping them safe. And this is where the governor's completely failed. He ought to be standing up there and saying, okay, within this framework, this is what you need. You need an infection rate lower than this. You need to do A, B, C, D, and E. And he's totally quiet.
There are hundreds of pages of documents of guidance
for schools
that are available from the administration.
Schools what to do to open. Joe Hogsett is showing more leadership than the governor is by saying what he's doing for high schools and middle schools in Marion County.
That is absurd.
And that is just a total failing on the governor's part. He doesn't want to offend the right wing of his party or his president and vice president.
That argument is just absurd by going on the internet and looking at the governor's office and the coronavirus website.
59 pages.
See,
it's like handing somebody a dictionary and say, write a sentence. That's what
that
is.
That's not true. You've got multiple state agencies, including the Department of Education, that are all involved in it and offering guidance.
Nikki, you're handing them a dictionary and writing
a
sentence.
To ask about high school sports, it seems to me that it makes sense, for instance, for golf to go on.
Sure.
You can very easily socially distance outside under golf, but
football,
you're not socially distancing during football.
Is a really challenging thing. I mean, not only can you not social distance there, and then think about 50, 60, you know, players in a locker room, in your shower. I mean, I just don't understand how that can go on. And I also wonder, and I couldn't tell if this was in the IHSAA's plan, but do you have to be having in-person instruction to be able to have sports? Because I don't know what kind of message that would send
if we can't go
to school, but you can go to your football practice.
I agree. That didn't seem super clear to me. So I don't want to say that isn't what they said. But should the IHSAA be saying, listen, I don't think there's a way to safely do X sport, but you can do Y sport? Or is it just, you make the call?
Yeah, I like the governor does.
I think it'd be a tough line to walk to tell some students that you can go play golf, but the other students, you can't go play football. I think you're going to have a lot more people upset in that scenario because it seems a little unfair in some regards. And I think this kind of just goes back to how we've had to make decisions all throughout the pandemic in terms of what's safe and what's not, and why is X safe but Y is not safe. And so it's a tough thing to decide, but I think it would be difficult to cherry pick sports.
All right, well, time now for viewer feedback. Each week, we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question, should the Indiana High School Athletic Association move forward with fall sports? A yes or B no. Last week's question, we asked, should people be fined for violating a mask-wearing order? 73% of you say yes to just 27% who say no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, Indiana leaders of both parties hailed former Governor Joe Kernan this week as an American hero and statesman. Kernan died Wednesday at age 74 after living for years with Alzheimer's disease.
Governor Eric Holcomb says Kernan modeled all the best of what it means to be a Hoosier.
And the challenges that he faced not only revealed his impeccable character, but they reminded us, inspired us, that we can all do better.
Indiana House Democrats said the former South Bend mayor exemplified what it meant to be a selfless leader. Kernan became governor in 2003 after the sudden death of Frank O'Bannon and made Kathy Davis the first woman to be lieutenant governor in the state's history. Senate Democrats called Kernan a true patriot and shining example of a public servant. The lifelong Hoosier spent 11 months as a prisoner of war during Vietnam. Former Governor Mitch Daniels, who bested Kernan in the 2004 election, said the Notre Dame graduate was always a friend, as Governor Daniels picked Kernan to help lead a major effort to reform local government.
Nikki Kelly, you covered Joe Kernan. What do you remember of him?
I mean, I think the easy question is we obviously know his history as in service. We know how easygoing and kind of a jokester he was and how kind of just welcoming he was. But I will forever remember the calm, soothing way that he guided everyone. The day he was sworn in, you know, hours after Governor O'Bannon died, and just how he held that room together just with his own will was pretty impressive.
What is Joe Kernan's legacy?
Well, I think one of the things that I read that I found really interesting was about his time as prisoner of war and the detail that he remembered from that incident. I mean, everything down to how fast the plane was going and what happened when it went down and he ejected himself. And even when he was being taken away after he was on the beach, and he remembers a kid threw a rock at him or a stone or something, and he joked that he thought that person would be a great baseball player. And it's a shame that, you know, he can't be in Indiana playing baseball. And so I think that goes to some of the other things that I read too, that he just had this great attitude about everything. I mean, that's a situation where you wouldn't expect to make a joke, and he was talking about it and making that comment.
What is Joe Kernan's legacy?
You know, something that I read about Governor Kernan that I did not know is after he lost the governorship, he went back home to South Bend, put a group of people together to buy the local baseball team, and was really involved in revitalizing downtown South Bend. I think there's a good lesson in there for politicians and folks in public service that, right, your life's not over if you lose an election, right? And you can go home and continue to do good in the community where you came from. I think that's great.
I hadn't known that about Joe Kernan, that he'd saved local baseball in South Bend before. Mm-hmm.
How cool is
before
that?
This week?
Played for Notre Dame.
Yes, he did. What do you remember of Joe Kernan?
I remember that in addition to the statesman and an advocate for women's rights, how considerate he always was, how kind he always was. When my daughter-in-law was pregnant with one of our grandchildren, we had all kinds of trouble, and the outcome was just originally supposed to be horrific. He picked up the phone and called. So, you know, no matter how high he rose, he was always thinking of other people. And I think he was a good man.
Yeah. I was saying just before we started talking about this that when someone passes away, you always think, you always hear the good stories and you rarely hear the bad. But I never heard a bad word about Joe Kernan before or after he died. Well, Ball State University will not require students or staff to be tested for COVID-19 before the campus fully reopens for in-person classes next month.
Employees already back to work at Ball State have been asked to self-monitor and self-certify they're not sick. It's a practice that will continue under a detailed screening plan released this week and will soon include students. Before moving into residence halls, students have two options: self-certifying that they've quarantined for 14 days before moving in, or presenting a negative COVID-19 test from within 7 days of moving in. In an email to campus, Ball State President Jeffrey Mearns says the school will have rooms available for students to quarantine or isolate in residence halls should they get the virus.
Lindsay or Doty, I don't want to make this just about Ball State, so I'm going to ask, in general, is the honor system the right way to do this?
Well, I think the thing with the honor system is, you know, I can be sitting here today, I don't feel sick, I feel fine, but you never know if you're asymptomatic. And there are a lot of cases where people have tested positive, and at the time, they were asymptomatic. So you just don't know. And if you are going and getting the test, at least then you do know at that moment in time, you were positive or you were negative.
I'm going to jump around a little bit because, Joey, you and I were talking about this just earlier. You even pointed out, though, and part of the problem with reopening at all is, if you go get a test, and one of the ways that Ball State is saying is, well, you can just self-certify, or you can show us that you had a negative test in the last 7 days. But if I went 7 days ago and got a test, I could have gotten it 4 days ago.
That's true. I think what all the universities, what every institution, right, in America, in the world right now, are trying to figure out, right, is use the best available science that you have to make as informed decisions as you possibly can. We've learned a lot since March, right? We now know masks, distance, and hand washing as best you can are incredible tools to stop the transmission of this virus. Testing and contact tracing scheme is also important for figuring out how to do this, but you've got to do it all. And I think it's unwise for us to assume that entire university communities are self-contained, right? I mean, the professors go home at night. Yep. The cleaning crew, right, goes home at night and comes back in. These are not the Disney World bubble, right? For the MBA, right? And we have to figure out how to deal with this using the best science we have.
We talked about that a few weeks ago when we talked about Purdue's reopening plan. The worry in a survey of staff and faculty was not, are people going to follow it on campus? It's, we worry that people aren't going to follow it when they go off campus,
yeah,
right?
And there's an element out there. I mean, there's an element, the anti-mask group, for example, and you had Donald Trump going to do a fundraiser in Texas just, was it yesterday or the day before, and not wearing a mask and not social distancing. So you have that out there. So I think Lindsay is correct. You've got to use whatever method you have. It may be true that you get tested, you don't have it now. You may get it again, but at least you know at that moment that person's free, because the estimates I've seen in public are that 25% of the people with the virus are asymptomatic. So that's a pretty heavy percentage when you look at how many have been infected nationwide.
That number was even higher in the Indiana study. It was, I think, 44% when they were tested had never shown symptoms. We didn't know if they'd got symptoms after that, but it's certainly troubling. The reality is, whether it's Ball State or any other university, we're just kind of, they're making plans, but there's an element here of crossing your fingers and hoping it works.
Yeah. Well, of course. And every student who decides to go back, you know, they're going to have to, every professor, they're going to have to take that risk. And everyone has to weigh that for their own self, their own personal underlying conditions, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, speaking of schools, the state's largest school district announced its plans to provide only remote learning to all students when classes resume next month. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Eric Weddle reports.
Indianapolis Public Schools says it will delay in-person instruction until at least October. That's intended to give more time for the number of COVID-19 cases in Marion County to decrease. Superintendent Alicia Johnson says there are substantial concerns about the safety of returning to the classroom. She says remote instruction will be more intentional than what was offered in the spring.
We're going to have to make sure we're paying special attention to how relationships are built between the teacher and the family, how we're making sure there's communication happening regularly between teacher and family.
All students will receive a device and, if needed, internet access. In-person hubs for students who get help with learning and therapy will be available. Students with special needs and housing instability are among those eligible.
And Delaney, Eric's last few lines there got to some of these issues, but how does a school district balance the concerns about COVID in the classroom with the problems that are created by virtual or only learning?
You know what I find interesting about this debate is that the Republicans have spent tens of millions of dollars, state tax dollars, on virtual learning, telling us it was one of the things that was going to make education sound in Indiana. And now it's the anathema. I think for IPS's situation, this is the only alternative. It's the largest school system in the state. They don't have the resources or the facilities to do the social distancing in the way that needs to be done. I think it's a perfectly sensible approach for them to take, and I'm just surprised that I'm hearing everyone, including Mike Pence, say that virtual learning is now terrible since they advocated it for so many years.
I actually do want to get to that point. We've debated virtual learning here in Indiana for a little while for reasons outside of perhaps the value of virtual learning, but and Republicans have stood by it. Should they be standing by it for everybody now?
Republicans stand for school choice, right? Meaning that for the individual child and for their family, that they should be able to make a decision about what's best for them. And I think in many cases, right, the school districts, for example, that are opening in-person classes as well are, I think, universally also offering a virtual learning option,
yes,
right, for
yeah,
families to choose which yeah, one is best for them, right? We don't know. If this kid lives with grandma, right, maybe it's best that that kid not be in in-person, you know, in-person classes. I think to conflate this with school choice and virtual charter schools with what we're dealing with in a pandemic is an unfair attack.
I don't think it's unfair because they're saying now that virtual learning harms children.
No.
Yes.
Some
that's what they're saying.
You suggest it's not as good.
There are, right? We're talking about giving people options versus yeah, forcing everyone into virtual learning. If we send all these kids from IPS,
you're saying it was good and now saying you're saying it's bad.
You can say no as many times as you like, Anne. It doesn't change the fact on the ground.
Yeah, it doesn't. That's right.
First day of school yesterday in Greenfield, and a junior high student, tested positive. He had taken the test. I don't want to say he. They had taken the test a few days prior, hadn't gotten the result, got the result that they were positive in the middle of the school day. If you're IPS, looking at that, are you going, yeah, this is the right, virtual only is the right call?
I mean, I think if you're really any school district leader, you might be looking at that and saying, ooh, maybe virtual is the way to go. And I think they have figured out a lot since March. You know, when March happened and they had to pivot to virtual learning, you know, within a couple of days, they weren't prepared for that. They didn't know how to do all these different things. And so now they've had time to figure out different ways to adapt, different programs they can have. They're going to have some options for kids who don't maybe necessarily have good internet at home or can't do the learning at home to come into certain places. So I think the virtual learning in the fall is going to be a lot different and a lot better than virtual learning in March.
I want to ask this about, and this is not, so IPS's plan said there's definitely not going to be in person before like October. Other schools are doing it a slightly different way. But unless everybody gets real on board with masks all of a sudden, and we're not going to have a vaccine before the end of this year, should parents and students and teachers be prepared to be virtual for a lot longer than a couple of months?
I'm one of those, you know, expect the worst and then be happy if it turns out better. So, yeah, I would absolutely expect it, and maybe it'll surprise them and improve. Yeah.
But if they're following the guidelines and they're wearing masks in school, right, and they're social distancing when you can't, right, when you can't be social distance, you're wearing a mask, you're washing your hands all the time, those are the guidelines for being able to open up safely. We've had daycares open in
that's
the state
true
for 5 months.
A lot longer than
a lot
that
of the schools can't socially distance, given the facilities.
Then you wear your mask.
Then you wear the mask all the time.
Well, you wear the mask, but even wearing the mask, you're supposed to mask, socially distance, and walk. It's not either or.
Yeah. All right. Well, finally, the Indianapolis Indians are considering a name change out of respect for the Native American community. So, Joey Fox, what's your pitch for a new name for Indy's minor league baseball team?
If it must be changed, then we should name it after the best team in Major League Baseball and just call it the Indianapolis Red Sox.
Okay.
Gross.
It's not
gross,
a farm
Joey.
Team for the Red Sox.
No, they aren't. The Pawtucket Sox, I believe, are the farm team.
I don't know, and I don't know about the debate. I find the name, the term Indians, not as offensive as Redskins, and maybe we ought to just consult and see whether the Indians in Indiana agree that that's okay.
I think that is one of the things they were doing. My pitch was the Indianapolis Crawfords, which was a Negro League team in Indianapolis, plus it has a connection to them.
Bill Crawford.
A notable leader here in Indiana and in Indianapolis. And that is Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Joey Fox, Lindsay Erdody of the Indianapolis Business Journal, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at wfyi.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Stay safe, stay healthy, and join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.